we often get people saying to us, suicide, oh my goodness, that's a difficult subject, and that sounds a really sad subject. And we say, well, it is. It's very sad, and it's tragic that we have so many preventable deaths by suicide. But suicide prevention is a happy, healthy, hopeful endeavor. We're helping to save lives. We're helping to prevent suicide. So
That's right.
we say, let's talk about suicide. We run events called Let's Talk About Suicide because talking about suicide is a part of the solution, a really important part of the solution.
Welcome to the Manage Self, Lead Others Leadership Podcast with Nina Sunday for experienced and aspiring people managers. This show will help you explore ways to become a more intentional leader. Each episode, host Nina Sunday speaks with some of the brightest business minds on the planet who share a passion to elevate and transform team culture. Workplace culture hides in plain sight. Is yours flourishing? Join the movement to make your workplace a better place to work. Are you ready? Because it's time to manage self, lead others.
Suicide prevention is one of the great transformational change challenges of our time. This episode, I speak with Paul Vittles, consultant and researcher and chief facilitator of the Zero Suicide Society Transformation Program in collaboration with the Jordan Legacy. Paul was a co-founder of the Baton of Hope UK, the biggest suicide awareness and prevention initiative the UK has ever seen. With over 30 years in senior leadership and CEO roles, and speaking to me from York, United Kingdom, welcome, Paul Vittles.
Let me just say that if anybody who is finding this a difficult conversation, there's lots and lots of help available. You can go to, there's loads of websites and source information. Australia, you've got Lifeline, and Lifeline in the US as well, Samaritans in the UK. Virtually every country now has lots and lots of information available.
Right.
And on the Jordan Legacy website, the Jordan Legacy, I'm a collaborative partner of the Jordan Legacy. There's also a well-being support grid, which I've designed. So we encourage people to think about the support they have around them from professionals, from family, different source of information. Be prepared. So go to those sites, stick it in your well-being support grid. And if your well-being support grid is full, you're fine. If you've got a blank sheet of paper in front of you, you're in trouble. Get help now.
Okay, so the Jordan Legacy, I saw the intro to that with Steve Phillip, and a very sad experience, and just, well, every experience is a sad experience. So,
yeah, and Steve lost his son Jordan to suicide on the 4th of December 2019. Steve had worked in business. He'd worked in high level marketing and sales positions with car companies like Honda. He'd worked in his own leadership development company. He ran a training business for LinkedIn. He's got 56,000 followers on LinkedIn, and his posts get over 1 million views regularly. When he'd lost his son to suicide, he realized he knew nothing about suicide. He knew very little about mental health, and he knew nothing about suicide. Mm-hmm. And so Steve's gone on a journey over the last few years to educate himself about it. And now he knows a lot about it, so he can help lots of people.
That's fantastic. And I'll have all the links in the show notes right at the top, so they're easy to find. Mm.
Yeah. Is this a global issue?
Yes.
Is this an issue around the world? Yeah. It is. Suicide is an issue all around the world. It is one of the biggest, it's the biggest killer of young people around the world. In Australia and in the UK, it's the biggest killer of men and women aged under 35. It's the biggest killer of men aged under 50. And people often are shocked just even by those basic statistics because they've never really thought about them before. When the United Nations set its strategic development goals, one of them was to reduce the numbers of suicides around the world by a third by 2030. And lots of things are happening around the world to try and achieve that. But it's different in every country because there are different issues and circumstances and different cultures and all sorts of factors to take into account and different means of ending your life as well. And so, for example, if you live in the US, you are particularly likely to shoot yourself.
Right.
The US had a record number of suicides last year, the highest it's ever been, 50,000 suicides. Over half were people using firearms.
Right.
Now, in Australia and the UK, we don't have many people kill themselves with firearms because they don't have access to firearms. So it's not rocket science, is it?
Yeah.
If you take the guns away, you reduce the risk of people harming themselves or harming others. Another interesting statistic is that men are significantly more likely than women to end their lives.
Right.
75% of all suicides are amongst men.
Oh,
right? But women are more likely to attempt suicide than men. So the reason why women are more likely to attempt suicide and men are more likely to die by suicide is the means they choose, the lethal means they choose to end their lives. So if you can change that, you fundamentally change the position.
Mm.
There's lots of things you can do to stop people getting to that point of crisis and then to stop them killing themselves at that point. But if you've got easy, ready access to guns like you have in the US, you don't give yourself a chance to actually do anything about it.
So how do you broach the subject with a group? Say you're in front of a group and they're there to hear this story. How do you start?
It depends on the nature of the group and the two extremes. I'll give you the two extremes. One extreme, which we get every single day in our work, is somebody contacting us saying, I've just lost my son to suicide. I've just lost my brother to suicide. I've just lost my sister to suicide, et cetera, et cetera. I want to do something about it. What can I do about it? I don't know anything about it. How can I talk about it? I need counselling. I need to help other people not be in this position that I'm in. So we work with those people to help them communicate, and they stumble initially, and they use phrases like commit suicide, which we tell people not to use because it implies that suicide is a sin or a crime. It's stigmatizing. And in most countries around the world, not all, but in most countries around the world, it is no longer a crime to attempt to take your life. We can maybe come back to that one later. Mm. But the other extreme, which we get every day with leadership teams, with partners of law firms, with senior political advisors, they know nothing at all about suicide and they're terrified of talking about it. They're absolutely terrified. They don't know where to start. They don't know how to continue the conversation. So we find a way of having that conversation with them. Like, for example, Steve and I run workshops called Having Difficult Conversations, including the S word. So we get people who don't want to talk about suicide, but they want to talk about having difficult conversations. So we go and have a conversation with them about difficult conversations. We ask them what they think difficult conversations are, and they talk about performance management and redundancy conversations and all this. So we let them talk about that, and we analyze the patterns in all of that. And then Steve and I do a facilitated conversation around suicide as a case study, where I ask Steve about all the conversations that he's had about suicide before and after Jordan's death and all the training that he's done and all the tips that he's learned. And then we do a reflection session at the end and we give them two guides, one to having difficult conversations generally and one to talking about suicide specifically, with lots of resources in there. And at the end of that workshop, they go, oh my goodness, I've just realized the reason why this is a difficult conversation is I've made it a difficult conversation.
Right. And lack of information or knowing exactly what to say is a gap in your knowledge bank. So hopefully this conversation is going to help people with that.
Yeah. And if you go and train to be on the Lifeline phones or on the Samaritan's phones in the UK, your training, and if you do mental health first aid training, suicide first aid training, assist training, all these brilliant courses that are out there, if you go and do any of those courses, they will say that if somebody is vulnerable, if somebody is any kind of risk whatsoever, you must ask direct questions. You cannot use euphemisms. You cannot sort of pussyfoot around it. You have to say to that person, have you had thoughts of ending your life? And if they say yes, have you made a plan to end your life? Because most people do make a plan and they rehearse it and it takes a while before they actually attempt suicide. So you've got lots of opportunities to keep that person safe and keep that person alive. But those direct questions terrify people. Most people think, oh my God, I can't ask that. I can't ask somebody if they've had thoughts of suicide or if they're thinking of ending their life. I mean, I might put the idea into their heads. Well, the evidence shows you don't put ideas into people's heads. If they're not suicidal, you don't make them suicidal. If they are suicidal, they answer the direct questions by saying yes. And they're often relieved that you've asked the question.
See, that's amazing, because I before you said that, I was thinking, how would I would almost offend a person by asking that question, or maybe nudge them in the direction I don't want them to go. So what you're saying is it's absolutely the right thing to do, and it won't nudge anybody that wasn't already on that path. And the person on that path making a plan is actually happy that someone has identified that they are in crisis. That's amazing.
They're more often than not, they are relieved and they think at last somebody's asked that question, at last somebody's noticed, last somebody's picked up some of those signs. And the thing is that it's a direct question. And I learned this from my research training. When I was a researcher many years ago, the very first training session I ever attended, a bunch of rookie researchers and interviewers, and they asked us about asking about age. And they deliberately got us to ask, how old are you? And lots of people told us to mind our own business, right? Because that sounds like a very personal question. And then they said, ask a factual question. What was your age last birthday? And everybody just answered the question. Right. So you make it a factual question. You say, have you had thoughts of ending your life? The answers to that question are yes or no.
That's actually a closed question.
It's a deliberately closed question. It's a factual question.
Right.
And so they don't think about it. They just answer the question. Have you made a plan to end your life? Yes, no. They answer the question. And then you've got a chance of helping them.
Right.
It's as simple as that.
And this is exactly what GPs could be told. This is what teachers could be told.
Correct. Yeah. And teachers are frightened to ask those questions. And we're doing lots of work in schools, which we can say a little bit more about. GPs as well are often scared to ask those questions. And they shouldn't be. They should be entirely comfortable or suitably uncomfortable asking those questions. But I'll just give you the Detroit case study, which everybody needs to know.
Right.
In Detroit, in the early 2000s, the Henry Ford Health System got the numbers of suicides in their health system down by 75% in 4 years. And by 2009, they actually had their first year with zero suicides, absolute zero, suicides at all in their system. And so we can study what they did to achieve that. One of the things they did was to ask those direct questions and to ask them sooner. So in 2000 or before 2000, what used to happen in a hospital in Detroit is that somebody would come into A&E, they'd be assessed, potentially with a mental health issue. They'd go for a mental health assessment. Potentially needing psychiatric care, they'd go off to the psychiatric hospital, the psychiatric unit, and have another assessment. They'd be seen by a psychiatrist, possibly a psychologist first, before the psychiatrist, but they'd be seen by a psychiatrist who would do another mental health assessment with them and would think this person is possibly at suicide risk and would then ask them the suicide questions. So just think about the number of steps that person has gone through before anybody's actually asked them they've had thoughts of ending their life. So they started asking those questions sooner and sooner and sooner and having continuous, learning sessions with all the staff to look at what they could do better and what would help and what would work. And eventually they just built them into the standard screening questionnaire when somebody comes into A&E.
Gee, right.
So they walk into
at
A&E,
the first point of contact.
Yeah. First point of contact, all the questions you get asked when you go into A&E, any of your medical history, all those things you get asked, at the point at which you're expected to be asked these questions, and you just answer the questions because you're just wanting treatment and care, so you answer the question. So ask people, have you had thoughts of ending your life?
So what's the percentage of people that do tell the truth and others who hide the fact they were thinking of it, but they say no? Does that ever happen?
Well, obviously, if you ask any question, some people might hide. But that's one of the reasons why you ask the direct question. So don't use the euphemistic language. Don't miss the opportunity to find out. If somebody is uncomfortable answering the question, you can usually tell that they're uncomfortable answering the question. Right. So you've got another opportunity there. Usually they are honest about it. And also we do, through myself and the Jordan Legacy and a research company in the UK called MEL Research, who do this pro bono for us, and they are incredible. Mm. We do a twice a year survey of a nationally representative sample of the population. And we ask all the questions that the government doesn't ask and hasn't asked for 10 years.
Right.
We ask people if they've had thoughts of suicide. We ask people if they've made suicide attempts. We ask all those questions twice a year on these surveys and track these things. And on those surveys, we get 40% of the sample, nationally representative sample, say they've had thoughts of ending their life. That's 2 in 5 of the population. The next question we ask is, would you say they are serious thoughts? You've seriously considered suicide? It goes down to 20%, but that's still 1 in 5 of the population say they've seriously considered suicide. And we have 1 in 6 of the population who have considered suicide within the past 12 months. We have 8% who have considered, had thoughts of suicide within the past month. Right now, if you look at your workplace, look around in your workplace, look around in your communities, you have got somewhere around about 1 in 10, 1 in 12 people who have thought about ending their life within the past month. Now, if you're not supporting those people, you are leaving those people to be vulnerable and potentially at risk of suicide. If you're talking to those people, you can potentially save thousands of lives.
Well, of course, there is a trigger that gets people started on that process. Have you identified the key trigger?
Yeah, the first thing to, I would say, is that there's loads of research being done on this. There's no shortage of research. People have been researching this for 50 years. Some people have been researching this full time in universities for 30 years, and it's all published, and increasingly it's publicly available. So there's no shortage of research and data. There's a myth, and a dangerous myth, that suicide is a mental health issue, that people have problems with their mental health, they become mentally ill, they become suicidal, they take their lives on some like neat linear path. It doesn't happen like that. First of all, it's not a neat path. Some people will have episodic mental illness, like myself. I've had mental illness for the past 20 years, and I'll have periods of episodes of depression, and I'll have episodes of being hyper-productive and changing the world. You know, that's the way my life works, right? But some people go in and out of hospitals. Some people will have mental health all their lives, but never be suicidal. Some people will self-harm their entire lives, but never actually intentionally try to end their lives. So it's very complicated. And then, secondly, and really importantly, it's not just a mental health issue. Most people in their lives in most countries have had no history, no prior history of mental ill health.
Right.
So what happens is they hit a crisis. They find one day they're in suicidal crisis the next.
What?
They lose their job. They lose their home. They lose their business. They lose access to their children. Their relationship breaks down, right? People have all of these crises, and they're not supported through these crises, and they lose hope, and they feel trapped, like somebody who's lost their job, gets no support. They might be working in a business where there's EAP, there's counselling, they have fun Fridays and bring people in to give them a massage and all that stuff that companies think is well-being, right, which isn't really, that's the fluffy stuff, right? They have all this support around them in a community at work, and then they lose their job. Now, they're already disheartened by the fact of being made redundant or that they've lost their job or whatever, and they haven't got their money to pay the bills. But they also go into the welfare system, which is soul-destroying. And people who've never been in the welfare system, you know, go down very rapidly. They get no access to counselling if they're unemployed. They're struggling to get a job, et cetera, et cetera. So these people hit crisis pretty quickly. And it's often said that a CEO of a business is only ever about 3 months away from a crisis, potentially a suicide crisis, because most people live, it's what Milton Friedman called the permanent income hypothesis. Most people live within the salary that they earn, so they get used to spending whatever they're earning.
And
if a CEO loses a job, they could be paid $5 million or something, but if they lose their job, they can often be in deep financial trouble within 3 months if they don't get another job quickly. And they can spiral into a suicide crisis.
People often associate themselves with their job, and without their job, they're nothing.
Yes.
And
that's right.
They have to...
It's called loss of identity, and you've got that in various forms. Somebody, like my first experience of suicide loss was in the early 1980s when I lived in Teesside in the northeast of England, and all the factories were shut down, all of the steelworks were shut down, all of the shipyards were shut down, the coal mines, all the apprenticeship schemes went. You know, I talk about that in other talks that I do in detail about what happened then. But these blokes were tough, hard blokes, very resilient blokes, no previous history of mental ill health, would never have gone near a mental health hospital apart from playing football in the grounds. And they would have felt that they had a job for life. Suddenly they had no job, they had no role, they lost their identity.
Right.
They were desperate to try and find a role for themselves, to find another job. They couldn't find a job. Some of them went off to the oil rigs in the North Sea. Some went to the construction sites of Germany. Some went to join the British Army, ended up in the streets of Northern Ireland. Now, they're not good places to be if your mental health ain't good at that time.
Right.
So a lot of them took their lives later. So loss of identity is important.
Oh.
And, of course, in Australia, you've got the Aboriginal population as well, the Indigenous population, where loss of identity is a massive, massive issue. And they have extremely high suicide rates amongst Indigenous communities.
Yes. I haven't quite grasped the fact that it's not a mental health crisis, because to me, mental health is you're not thinking of suicide. Am I wrong?
No, it's a complex thing. The best way I can explain it is that, first of all, we have a national database here called NCISH. All suicides are recorded on that database, and analysis is done by the University of Manchester. That shows only a quarter of people who take their lives have had any form of NHS mental health treatment or care. They've never been near NHS, but the vast majority have never been near mental health institutions of any kind. More have seen their GP. Probably two-thirds have seen their GP within 3 months, but most of them have gone with a physical health ailment because they were too scared to say that they were struggling in any other way. So mental health is an issue, but it's the other aspects of the crisis. It's the financial crisis, the housing crisis, the relationship crisis often brings on their suicide crisis and causes the mental health issue. So at the point at which somebody is thinking of taking their life, of course they are mentally distressed. There's no question. But they may not have been until like a week or 2 weeks before that crisis. They've never had any history of mental health. So the source is not their mental health issues. And I did a podcast recently in the UK called Suicide is a Means of Death, Not a Cause of Death. Suicide is a means of death, not a cause of death. It's the means they choose when they feel trapped and they feel there's no other option. But it's not the cause. The causes are these underlying factors like housing and homelessness and injustice. You know, we've got a session at our conference coming up on injustice-related suicides where people have been systemically discriminated against or discriminated against by the family court in terms of access to children.
What's the essential information you want to communicate to people listening, and what can they do to self-educate?
Like I said earlier, there's so many sites available that people can get information. They can go to the ZeroSuicideAlliance.com website and take the training there. 20-minute online training will give you all the basic information and tools to have a conversation. We say to people, don't just say to people, have a conversation, because they're terrified about that. Say, take the training and have a conversation.
Yes, because then you know exactly what to say. You've got the backup. And you don't know what you don't know till you do a little training course.
Yeah, and then the training is available. So mental health first aid was actually pioneered in Australia. Then you've got Living Works, the Assist program, which is pioneered out of Canada. Lots and lots of training courses. You can do a day, 2 days training, and you should do it, just like physical first aid. And doctors, we have doctors who say they get annual training in CPR, resuscitation, right? They get annual training and audited. They get no training in suicide prevention. We say to them, when was the last time you had to resuscitate somebody? And they go, about 8 years ago, I think it happened once. And we say, right, and when was the last time somebody came to your surgery and said they were having thoughts of suicide? Last week. Okay, so you're audited, you're trained and audited annually for something you might use once every 8 years. You get no training on something you have to deal with every week. That doesn't make sense, does it? So none of this makes sense. We have in the UK 6,000 preventable deaths by suicide every year. In Australia, 3,000 preventable deaths by suicide every year. We should be doing something about this. And what we are doing, what I'm doing, and Steve Phillip and the Jordan Legacy, what we're doing is we are doing something about it. We've done research on this. We've done a massive action research project. I've written a 36,000 word critique of the government's national strategy, which is completely hopeless and useless. And I've even said that it's the national suicide prevention strategy that prevents us from preventing suicides. It's got awful low ambition, and we can't have low ambition in suicide prevention. We've got to have high ambition. Low ambition kills people. That's what we say. Low ambition effectively kills people. So we are rolling out a tour across the Humber to the Mersey in the UK in the summer, a conference where we're bringing people together, speakers and panel members, for every piece of the puzzle.
That's schools, in June 2024. In
June 2024.
In Leeds or where?
It's going across from the Humber, from Scunthorpe on the East Coast across to Merseyside, with events and activities all the way across, with education, with advocacy, with audits of higher education institutions, with film screenings, with live rugby league matches. We're taking over a live rugby league match, I think, at one point. And then when we get to Liverpool, we're getting to Liverpool in time for the Global Zero Suicide Summit, which is taking place in the UK for the first time on the 24th and 25th of June. It has taken place in Sydney in the past, and it's gone around the world, a bit of Rotterdam.
This so is it the moves first around, so people could stay in touch and find out if they can't be in the UK this year, they can find out where it's going to be next year.
Yeah, and there's a zero suicide movement. There are 120 countries around the world that are looking at what Detroit did in 2000, how they got the numbers down and what they can do to get the numbers down. In Australia, there is a Zero Suicide Institute of Australasia run by Sue Murray, which is fantastic, and Sue is amazing.
So I think we'll include all these references, all these links in the show notes. And you've got a couple of
Just one final thing, if I can, just one final thing. We wanted to have a big finish in Liverpool, in Merseyside.
Yeah.
And we went to one of the biggest venues there, one of the biggest music venues, was 5,000 capacity. And we said to them, you know, could we use your facilities? And they said, yes. We've actually been following you and Steve and the Jordan Legacy for the past 3 years. And we think it's amazing what you're doing. We want to support what you're doing. We want to give you all our facilities for all day Saturday, the 22nd of June, and all day Sunday, the 23rd of June, at no charge.
That's wonderful.
So we're organising a massive festival. And also other iconic gatherings. We're going to have a Hope gathering on Hope Street in Liverpool. Hope Street runs between the two cathedrals. So we're going to have a Hope gathering on Hope Street and bring together everybody. When I go to business conferences, people say, what business are you in? I say, we're in the Hope business.
Lovely.
That's what we do, in the Hope business. So we're going to get all the Hope people together, including Bernie Hollywood, who rowed his boat of Hope across the Atlantic single-handedly.
Yes.
Fueled on by videos of Hope from the school kids of Liverpool. And we've also spoken to Liverpool FC. And I've pitched an idea to them.
Is that football club?
Liverpool Football Club, the famous Liverpool Football Club, Anfield, the Cop, right?
Yeah.
And their famous song, you know, You'll Never Walk Alone, the famous song they all sing together.
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, I've pitched this idea to them and they haven't said yes yet, but they haven't said no yet. So this is the idea. We get together on the Cop, a whole bunch of people who have been... who have felt so alone in their lives at some point in their lives that they thought of ending their life, or have lost all hope to the point where they thought of ending their life, or have a loved one who was in that situation. And we all get together on the Cop or wherever we can do this in Liverpool as a mass choir, and we all sing together, You'll Never Walk Alone, with hope in your heart.
Oh, that gives me a chill. That's fantastic. So anybody that might be in the United Kingdom, say you got a trip to London, fit Liverpool in at the end of June.
Liverpool, 22nd, 23rd of June, be in Liverpool.
Yeah.
It'll be a unique event. Probably it's never been done before and possibly never it will never happen again.
And having said that, there's the annual conference, which we'll have the link for, and there'll be a couple of PDFs that people can download.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Paul.
And again... bear in mind, everybody, we'll finish as we started. There's lots of help out there. You are never alone. There are so many helplines and source information and counsellors and peer support groups. On our stage in Liverpool, we've got 15-year-old Alfie Fitzsimmons. He lost his dad to suicide when he was 8 years old. And when he was 9 years old, he set up a charity because there was no peer support groups for kids bereaved by suicide. He set up Alfie's Squad. It's phenomenally successful. It was on BBC Breakfast last week. He's going national. He's setting up Alfie's Squad online. And we're going to have him on our stage at the Merseyside Festival.
One thing I also want to mention, I go to different workplaces when I'm delivering training. And I notice at one workplace, you know how they'll have the first aid wardens and the emergency wardens. This organisation also had the mental health first aid officers. Which means they've been trained probably by Mental Health First Aid Australia, because there are lots of trainers who are accredited there.
Yeah.
And so that must be a trend that organisations now understand that we have to look after the mental health and have people who are trained in that, so they actually know how to have that conversation. Because a manager might be observing the behavior, but maybe they want to get help themselves in how do I deal with this.
And I'll be quick on this one because I know we're short of time here, but when I was in Australia, I worked with the Mentally Healthy Workplace Alliance, which was set up as a partnership between government, business and charities like Beyond Blue, and also Superfriend, which was set up as a not-for-profit foundation to reduce suicides, funded by the superannuation and insurance sector. That was enlightened self-interest, because they'd got to the point where 50% of claims were now mental health related. So they had to do something about mental health and suicide prevention. And they, of course, realised that suicide is bigger than mental health. But so we did some work with them. And we also did some research going into these insurance companies, and they were trying to develop these new services for people, brand new services, new ideas, checking on people's mental health. Some of those people who'd worked there for 50 years said, we used to have that years ago, you know, we used to call it the chaplain, the chaplaincy service, right? People used to come round and check up on us all the time. We got rid of all of those 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So mental health first aid was developed in 2000 in Australia and now it is all around the world. But just bear this in mind that we have had, I'll give you two final facts and statistics. One is that, yes, there is an increasing number of people doing mental health first aid and suicide first aid and other courses like that. And we've done research with them and we've found that that is helping and it gives people more confidence in having conversations and picking up issues and they can go to their mental health first aider. But it also puts an enormous pressure on the mental health first aider as well. And some of those are stressed out by being the only mental health first aider in their organization. So we've set up peer support groups for those mental health first aiders to check, to look after themselves. The other, here's the final statistic. We, in our national tracking survey, we ask people if they've taken any training in mental health or in suicide prevention. And one of the reasons we did this was because we have a lot of training providers now, and sometimes they do compete with each other, and they shouldn't. They should collaborate, right? There's no place for competition in suicide prevention. Competition kills people, we say that, right? Here's the statistic. 6% of the population have had any form of training in suicide prevention. 6%. That means 94% haven't. That's the opportunity that we have.
That's right.
And that's the opportunity all these training providers have. And you know what it's like in a marketplace, Nina? You know, if you've got 94% of the market to go after, why would you be fighting over the 6%?
Yes.
You'd be going, you'd be collaborating and going out to make sure you've got, you know, full potential from the 94%. And everybody benefits, society benefits. The economy benefits. It costs the UK economy £10 billion a year as preventable suicide deaths. There's a business case for this. So, yeah, let's all do it. Let's go out there. And it is a transformational change challenge. Let's rise to that challenge.
And people can contact you on LinkedIn?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm the only Paul Vittles on LinkedIn, so I'm easy to find there. You can contact me through the Jordan Legacy. I've got a profile on the Jordan Legacy website.
Jordan Legacy, yes.
I have a Medium account from all my blogging and articles. There's lots of great stuff on there, including the critique of the national strategy, including articles and research and so on, is what we're going to do after the tour. So after the June tour, when we finished in Merseyside, finished at the Global Zero Suicide Summit, I will then launch my new CIC business, which will be 100% dedicated to rolling out this transformational change program. And I'm working with the University of York on this as well. Well, Steve and I carried out this action research project. Some of the interviews lasted 3 hours and we asked one question. What practical actions will reduce the suicide numbers and get them on a downward trend towards zero? And that's it. That's the only question we ask. And people tell us all these things we can do. So that's the hope. That's where the hope lies.
Yes.
There's so much we can do practically to reduce these numbers and get them down towards zero. And if people say, oh, but we've got 3,000 deaths in Australia and we've got 6,000 in the UK and we've got 50,000 in the UK, you're not going to get those numbers down to zero. We say, eat the elephant one bite at a time.
That's right.
Break it down into its chunks. If you go into your community, your workplace, your school, your hospital, your family, and you say, what's your, here's a provocative question maybe to finish with, what is your target for the number of suicide deaths in the next 12 months if you get
That's
all
right.
business? Right? Well, the target's zero, isn't it? The target has to be zero, doesn't it? So lots and lots of micro zeros add up to a macro zero.
Yeah. Well done. Thank you for filling us with hope. Thank you for filling us with a where to from here. I felt ignorant about the whole issue, and now I feel like I can move forward and I can have that conversation if I feel it's needed. So, thank you so Brilliant. Much for sharing that. It's just wonderful, Paul, the work that you're doing.
Thank
well
you for done. Thank you for giving me the opportunity, Nina. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks very much. This episode, we've been speaking with Paul Vittles, who's involved with the Zero Suicide Prevention Society Transformation Program. They're organising their big conference in, across the UK, culminating in Liverpool at the end of June. and they have this the Join the Dots tour, and they have so many links to so many good programs that globally you can catch up with. So check out the show notes. It's been a real privilege speaking with Paul Vittles today. Thank you for listening, and until next time, bye for now.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.